The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Ruth Schaber, a proud supporter of the library. Tonight's author event, along with many other critical and enriching programs, are made possible through generous support from people like you. Please consider making a gift and helping the Free Library advance literacy, guide learning, and inspire curiosity for all Philadelphians. On behalf of my family, we welcome you to the Free Library of Philadelphia and the Sandra Schaber Memorial Lecture. Tonight's speaker and I have something very significant in common. We both had very dynamic and very outspoken mothers. In my case, my mother Sandra had an insatiable curiosity about current events, history, and people. She was an ardent feminist, early member of the National Organization of Women, and emphasized to her children, granddaughters, and nieces the importance of women being able to control their own destiny through financial and reproductive independence. We all wish you were here tonight to enjoy this evening's guest speaker. And I am delighted to introduce you to Cecile Richards. Cecile was the president of Planned Parenthood Federation of America and the Planned Parenthood Action Fund from 2006 to 2018. And I had the good fortune during Cecile's career at Planned Parenthood to be a passionate supporter of the national organization, both personally and through the Tara Health Foundation. Cecile is the daughter of the legendary Ann Richards. Cecile began her career in the labor movement, then helped her mother become Texas's first Democratic women governor. Later, she served as Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi's deputy chief of staff. When she started her famous tenure at Planned Parenthood, I doubt that she would have guessed that her heroic leadership there would have resulted in the riveting marathon testimony that she gave to Congress on September 29, 2015. Cecile, you are a rock star. In her new book, Make Trouble, she tells her unique and inspiring story and offers practical advice for a new generation of leaders. She will be talking tonight with Tamela Edwards, the anchor of 6 ABC Action News Morning Edition. What a great conversation we have to look forward to. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Cecile and Tamela.
We were so busy talking backstage, Andy had to push us out onto the stage. Like, let's go, people. Thank you so much for coming to the Free Library this evening, and thank you for joining us.
It's exciting to be here.
To talk about your book. I told her, all you have to do is have fun and be yourself. These are great crowds, and I'm sure you will prove me right shortly. So, Cecile, there's something I didn't tell you, because I wanted to save it for when we were on stage.
Oh, no, I hate that.
I know you
right.
do.
I hate that.
But you're going to like this one. So, 1988, I'm from Houston.
You are.
I become governor of Texas Girl State. And one of the prizes was getting to meet the state treasurer, who is Ann Richards.
Right. Amazing.
It was amazing at that time, and little did we know. Though I think we could tell. She was a lady on a mission.
Right.
She was 2 years out from becoming the actual governor of Texas.
Right.
And so my first question to you is, so many people have a sense of your mother one way or the other. You have a very different sense. What was it like to be Ann Richards' daughter?
Well, first I just want to give a plug for Girls State.
Yes,
I think it is
wonderful.
Really underestimated what, particularly in a state like Texas, what an opportunity that was. And obviously, because it produced you, it's like incredible. It's just unbelievable.
It was an amazing experience.
Yeah. Some people think, you know, when they say what was it like to be Ann Richards' daughter, is like for most of my life, she was what we called a housewife, right? She wasn't this, you know, feminist icon, you know, running, taking over the world. And so it's funny that, growing up in Dallas, Texas, mainly You know, my dad was a civil rights attorney. My mother was taking care of four kids, working on campaigns. They were against everything happening in Texas. So it was like, I grew up in a family where...
So were my parents.
Yeah, it was just one of that. So it, I think I did learn that from her early on, which was you had to kind of just speak up for what you believed in. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, you were going to be maybe the only person who did. Our dinner table was never where we ate. That was where you sorted precinct lists for whatever campaign they were working on. So she was always like that. She was always an activist, but it wasn't until she, the women's movement came around, and then she just really lost her mind and just, you know, went full hog into that. Ran Sarah Weddington's campaign. I talk about this in the book, and then, you know, of course, ran herself. I think the two things, though, that I'll say that maybe seem counterintuitive. One was it wasn't like anyone ever asked her to run for office. It wasn't like there was this group that got together and said, you're the one. And I think this is so many women think, okay, someone's going to finally ask me. And just usually that doesn't happen. And she figured that out, that if she was going to actually run for governor, if she was going to run for treasurer, all the other offices, you know, in the election she ran for, she was just going to have to do it despite the fact that no one was looking for a woman to run. And even when she ran for governor, that was true. And that really... to me, informed kind of her attitude as she went through life, which was to tell young women to just, the answer is yes. Whatever it is, just do it. Because if you're waiting around until
someone asks,
or you've got the perfect resume, or, I mean, she would go through all the reasons I think that as women, we sometimes take ourselves out of situations because the kids are too young, the kids are too old, you just go through it, or don't have the right degree, don't know the right people. She just was having none of that. And I think that she would be so excited right now to see this record number of women of color serving in Congress. She would just be out of her mind. Like,
one of the interesting things about your book are there are a lot of things that seem to be precursors to where we are now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of this is not new to you, starting with the man that your mother ran against.
Yes.
Clayton Williams, who, bit bombastic, if he could have been tweeting, he would have, and you wouldn't have liked it.
Right.
And she had to make her way through it, and you kind of joke that it reminds us of where we are now. So when you Absolutely. People ask you for advice on what to do in this moment, it is like wrestling an oiled pig sometimes to figure out what you're going to do, because he's so good at what he does.
Right.
And so people have to decide, do you take him on? Do you do something different and get run over? What is your advice to people who say, I want to take him on?
And by him, I mean
the president.
You're meaning 45. Okay.
Yeah.
One thing my mother used to say, which there's a lot of Ann Richardsisms sort of sprinkled throughout this book, but she used to love to quote Edna St. Vincent Millay, who wrote, you know, life isn't one thing after the other. It's the same damn thing over and over again.
Yes.
And so I do think there are things that we are obviously repeating a lot of bad habits and a lot of bad precedent. I don't know how to, quote, take him on, although I do feel like we have got to start ignoring him. It is really frustrating, you know, so he gets way too much attention. And as we know, anyone who's raised children, I raised three, you know, the last thing you want to do is reward bad behavior. And I feel like with this president, we do reward bad behavior. And the media, you know, follows his every idiotic tweet. I actually was writing a little bit about this week, which is my frustration over this is that then issues like the issues that I'm hearing women talk about today in real life, the concerns that women have, that we have no national child care policy, that two-thirds of minimum wage workers are women, and those that are moms are spending two-thirds of a very small salary on child care. The fact that we have a maternal mortality rate in this country that's going up, and for black women, it's really
outrageous.
Going up. This is what I want the government to focus on. This is what I think the media should be talking about. But instead, we are spending way too much time letting Donald Trump carry us on his merry way. And we got to start talking to women in this country and voters about what we care about and what we're ready to do in this country, not about what this guy's doing. And that, to me, is like essential if we're going to change things.
Not only were you are you the daughter of a seminal candidate, your own daughter worked for Hillary.
Yep.
She's working for Kamala right now. We see a landscape where we see a number of women stepping up and saying they want to run. But again, an echo back to your mother, the way that we talk about female candidates in ways that we don't talk about male candidates.
Right.
What do you see out there and what can be done about it?
Well, first, can I just say, and I worked for, I volunteered for Hillary, worked really hard in that campaign. I think that it's important to just take a moment and just give credit for the fact that because Hillary Clinton ran for president is a large part of the reason we have six women now running for president of the United States, and that's a huge thing. So partly it is just women showing that it can be done, and I think so. I appreciate the fact that we now have more women reporters like you and others, women on in the most prestigious newspapers who are finally calling out some of sort of the double standard, because that frankly wasn't happening so much before. Women are having platforms and social media, and I think that really matters. But still, 2/3 of political reporters are men. And so I think one of the things we can do is demand equity in the newsroom so that women actually have an equal chance of getting covered. I think sometimes we just have to sort of like take it with a grain of salt and point out the hypocrisy. And then we were talking back, behind stage. I know I'm from Texas. Beto is an amazing candidate. But can you imagine a woman jumping up on a car and like yelling and screaming and trying to run for president? It just would like not happen. So... and that's probably a good thing.
It was the dental appointment that I don't think a woman could do.
And the dental appointment would have never worked out. But you're right. I mean, I think women have always had to be better. But I think the exciting thing, and I was talking to Lauren Underwood about this last night, this amazing young congresswoman from Illinois, is that the exciting thing to me is right now we have six women running for president, and they're completely different. I think it used to be, if you're going to run for office, you had to have my mom used to say, pick a hairstyle and stick with it, girl. That's the only way you're going to get elected. And you know what? She had a point there. Yeah. Hillary said once, I wish I'd listened to her. But I do think that there used to be, a lot of rules. You had to do this a certain way. And I think it's exciting to think that you have such a diversity of women running. And they're not a monolith. And that to me is a good sign.
Part of the book is, I think you wanted to, people have ideas about you or ideas about your mom. You wanted to be a human and talk about who you really were. So that's where this question is coming from. You talk about your mom and dealing with alcoholism, something she talked about recently in the news. Amy Klobuchar, I'll learn to say her name one day.
Klobuchar, that's okay.
When she's President Klobuchar, I'm sure I will get it correct.
You'll get it down. Yeah.
She talked about what it meant to be the child of an alcoholic, and she's written about it. And on a personal level, she said it always affects you, and I wondered, how did it affect you? How does it stay with you?
I guess as a child, having a parent who went through a very public, she went through, her sobriety was a very public issue, and it was really, really hard, although it completely saved her life, probably ended her marriage, but so it had all kinds of repercussions. I guess I hope, on the one hand, if you grow up with a parent who's an addict, there's all kinds of course, behavioral things that you just like learn and then you like never want to repeat with your own kids, I think. But it also, I guess the thing, mom's sobriety was so important because she got sober and was public about it before it was cool. It was way before people like went off to fancy places. I mean, she went to the Hard Knocks. She went to Minnesota, and it was like, no BS, you're not going to ever have another drink, and she never did. And it was really the fact that she was public at a time in which here she is, a divorced woman, a progressive, and now she's a recovering alcoholic, was almost like, would just have like taken you out of the public sphere, but she just kept fighting back. And I think people liked that about her. And it's interesting, even though, yes, people stop me almost every week and repeat the George Bush line from the Atlanta Democratic Convention, almost as many people will stop me and say, I got sober because your mom. And I think a lot of people don't realize how important that was at the time and continues to be to be public about the issue of addiction.
A lot of your focus has been on women's issues, mm-hmm. things you've done, things you're planning to do. One of the things we keep hearing, and this book is supposed to be a primer, I think, for activists, for women in particular, women are being told over and over again to figure out their way to lean in. And I thought you'd have an interesting perspective because on one hand, part of your life has been in very elite rooms with mm-hmm. very powerful women, but also part of your career is with women who are cleaning bathrooms and being mistreated and not making enough money. So you have a perspective on women on both ends of the scale. What does it mean to be a woman, you think? How should we be defining lean in? What does that really mean? Does it work for everybody, and how should it work?
Yeah, I mean, I don't necessarily come out of, I mean, I guess for folks who that works for, the lean in thing, that's fine. That's not really, I guess that's not really what I come out of. I write in the book, I when I left college, I became a union organizer, organizing women who cleaned hotel rooms in New Orleans for a minimum wage, many of whom were single mothers, many of whom were working two jobs. And I guess if I have women, sometimes people say, like, who are the women you look up to? It was those women that were literally formed my sort of understanding of the world to the extent I have one at all. Here are women who had absolutely nothing to fall back on, right? I mean, they had no savings. They were struggling to kind of make ends meet. I mean, they had a community of sisters that they all kind of had to pull through together. And yet they were willing to risk all of that to organize a union to make a better living. If not for themselves, maybe for the women that came afterwards. And that to me is like, that's the most courageous work. And those are the most courageous women I was ever around. And I feel like, and I guess that's why, you know, when I say make trouble, I think making trouble is it's a privilege. It's a privilege. And so people say to me, wow, you know, your job must be really hard at Planned Parenthood. It's like, are you kidding? Hard is working in a nursing home in East Texas when you can't get any other job for minimum wage. And those are the women I hope that we have to constantly lift up, support. Their issues are our issues. And I hope that in the work that I did at Planned Parenthood and the work I'm trying to do now, those are the women I wish were more part of the political conversation in America, because they are the backbone of this country.
Let's talk a little bit about the political conversation in America, because there's a scene in the book, your mom's running for re-election, and you go someplace, you think, these are my people, organized yeah. labor, and the reaction you get is not very friendly. And yeah. again, an echo to now, where a lot of the people that 45 has managed to reach are people that you would have thought would have been in the Democratic coalition, right. organized labor, particularly from certain demographics. What needs yeah. to be done to talk to those people? And I asked that a couple of weeks ago. I was here with Pete Buttigieg, mm-hmm. who talked about how we talk to those people. What did you learn out of that? And how should we be trying to talk to those people to put them back in your coalition?
I mean, I guess I think fundamentally I would flip it around and mm-hmm. say we need to be talking less at those people and listening to those people. Mm-hmm. I feel like we're just not doing enough listening. And one of my frustrations actually after the last election was, you know, folks saying, well, why are all these women voting against their own self-interest? And I just think we try to step back and say, well, actually, do you know what their interests are? Have we actually spent any time hearing from folks? Because I think we make assumptions. We make assumptions even about people's lives, about, and so I think it's, and that's why I've been so interested in spending this last year actually just listening to women, what's on their minds. Because I do think we are in this hyper-partisan environment in Washington. And I think sometimes the media tends to report on the things that just like rip people, you know, like the two extremes. And really, when you go out and listen to women in particular, and that's who I've been most interested in, the things that women share in common are so much greater than what divides us. And it's why I think that if we had a political process here that actually lifted up those voices and issues that women are struggling with every day, some of which I mentioned earlier, I think we'd have more women invested in voting, more women invested in running for office, more. And so that to me is, it's less about what we need to talk to people about and more what we need to hear from them and understand where they're coming from. Because Yeah, I think this last election, a lot of people, and we also have to be honest about some serious issues we got in this country, because it's not just like, oh, if we listen, everybody. Like, racism is a huge problem in this country, and we have never dealt with it. And that is just, like, fundamental. So I don't want to paint this like Pollyanna view of the country. In fact, one of the interesting things, you know, I've been following the trends of women voters. As I said, 54% of the voters in this last election were women. Overwhelming majority voters for the first time. Actually, you know, women of color have always been progressive voters, overwhelmingly progressive voters, particularly African American women, and they turn out to vote for the first time in decades. White women actually split their vote for Democrats and Republicans this last November, which has led to a lot of the victories we saw. But one of the things we have to acknowledge and look at more deeply is that in the state of Georgia, where Stacey Abrams, like the most exciting candidate, hands down, in the country, in my opinion, historic race for governor, 72% of white women in Georgia voted for her opponent. So we got a lot of work to do in this country with women and recognize
that. Can you change those minds?
I think you can. I think we have to, and this is, and part of what I'm really interested in now is how do we build a multiracial, multigenerational movement of women? Because I do think there are women who are kind of beginning to, like, the light bulb's going off, and they're realizing that they don't know enough about what it's like to live as a woman of color in this country. And I think there are some openings, but it's not going to be easy, and I think we're not going to do ourselves a service unless we have to confront the issue of race head on, and it means having conversations at the community level and at the neighborhood level in a way that I just don't think we ever really have. Bryan Stevenson, who's like this, you know, such an incredible author, and obviously he's devoted his entire life to this issue. He said, you know, you kind of can't have a truth and reconciliation process around the issue of slavery until you talk the truth, right? Until you actually address the truth about how this country was founded. And so I just think that I don't want to gloss over the challenge, but I do believe that women are ready to do that work, and that's the work I'm interested in.
A question from the headlines. Can you believe we're still fighting over the ACA, the Affordable Care Act? I mean, it's been a minute. Like,
there's so many stupid things. It's one of the stupidest things I've heard him say. I really do believe. And it's like, just forget it. Like, just that it's the wrong thing. I mean,
work the last time.
I'm trying to separate out, like, the things that are just, like, dead wrong and the things that are just, like, stupid. And this is, like, dead wrong and stupid. Right? Doesn't make sense. He just lost Congress over this issue of kicking people off their health care plans, of not protecting folks with pre-existing conditions. Why does he want to do this again? But I just, like, game on. We're ready to go. I mean, I have so many stories in the book about, oh my God, dealing with the Affordable Care Act and all the other things and the fight over getting birth control. But, you know, one of the best fights, of course, was getting maternity benefits, because I remember one of the senators, John Kyle from Arizona, said he didn't think that insurance companies should need to cover maternity benefits because he was never going to need them. I know. Apparently, he was past his childbearing years at that moment. But this is why we need more women in office, is because Senator Debbie Stabenow from Michigan turned right around and she said, well, I bet your mother needed them. But anyway, I mean, it is funny, but it was a fight to get maternity benefits. And when 45 came in office and they wanted to pass Trump Care, one of the things, there was this incredible meeting, you know, kind of at the, like, in the pitch battle. I remember I was at the Capitol, and he calls, or Mike Pence calls the Freedom Caucus to come over to the White House to have a sit down so they can finally get the final details of this, of Trump Care, because they were short some votes. And of course, in that meeting, they negotiate away maternity care for women. And I'm sitting over the Capitol, I'm thinking, God, I wish I could get a picture of that room, because you know it is all white men making this. Okay, and wouldn't you know it, literally, 1 minute later, Mike Pence tweets out a photograph of all of them in the White House. I mean, and it was just like, we just blew it up. It was just amazing. But I think the fact that we are now, that he is going to relitigate issues that I think people feel like, this is actually good having healthcare coverage. You know, this is actually a good thing. This is for women, getting maternity benefits, it's a good thing. Birth control, hugely popular. And now 72 million women have it. So the thought that they're going to relitigate this to me is just crazy.
I would say, though, you got a really good tweet out of it. She sent out a picture of dogs and said that they were debating feline care.
Right.
That's how it had been working for these men to be debating maternal care. So when you head the Planned Parenthood, obviously there are people who feel very strongly and very differently than you do about abortion, and you have to figure out how to talk to them. In this country, we're trying to figure out how to talk to people when we feel very, very differently. How did you negotiate or figure out how to talk to somebody who, the two of you could be decent together, but just fundamentally, they just did not believe in abortion?
Well, I guess what I, one is, well, I'll say this. I totally respect every person's right to make their own decisions about their pregnancy and about abortion. That it's a very personal issue. All I'm saying is, that should be the right of every person to make that decision for themselves. It should not be the government's right to make that decision for pregnant people. And that's, I do think that, and we learned this at Planned Parenthood, because for years there's been this sort of binary, you know, language of like, you're either pro-choice or you're pro-life, and we, you know, those terms don't really mean anything to anyone, and I think they've been misused. And so once you actually kind of take the political language out of it and you actually just have a conversation with people, the vast majority of people in this country agree that pregnant people should be able to make their own decisions. And I saw this firsthand in both the state of South Dakota, very conservative state, and the state of Mississippi, where the legislature had passed abortion, essentially abortion bans, and the voters of those states overturned them by big numbers. And so I think that part of this is we just have to have a more open conversation and allow people to have their own personal point of view and say, like, I'm not trying to tell you what's right for you. And what we saw is that people in South Dakota and Mississippi said that they could hold their own point of view, but also recognize that they couldn't make those decisions for everybody else. And that's where this country is. But it means being willing to, I mean, knock on doors, have community meetings, go to churches, do the kinds of things, and having honest conversations with people. I think the interesting thing is that in this era of 45 and now Justice Kavanaugh, we can talk about that. Support for Roe is stronger than it's ever been since it was decided. And also, in another sort of ironic twist, since we got birth control coverage in the Affordable Care Act, we're actually at a 30-year low for unintended pregnancy and the lowest rate of abortion since Roe was decided as well, and the lowest rate of teen pregnancy in history. So, and I think that's where most people are. They, you know.
Do you feel as though birth control and the coverage and the things that you've offered, do you feel as though that's set, or is that something that you think could be challenged?
Oh my God, he's trying to take that away. Absolutely. I mean, it's incredible. I mean, if we overturn the Affordable Care Act, everything that gets covered is, it's
back,
like, we're back at square one. And honestly, and I talk about in the book, getting birth control coverage, it was a fight with the Obama administration. It is, everything we ever get that's worth anything, we have to fight for. That is just a truism about life. If it's something worth, you know, if it's worth anything, it's worth fighting for. And so that could absolutely change. And I was talking to Lauren Underwood about that last night. She says, I don't think all these young women know that birth control at no cost isn't something you just, like, get from, like, the minute you get to this earth. That was something people fought for, and that is absolutely will be a huge issue. If this is the route they're going down, this is going to be a huge issue in this campaign.
One of the organizations you ran, America Votes, was about getting various progressive groups together. Hey, guys, all you cats, let's go in this direction and try to do something. When you look at the race right now, it feels as though we're stuck on a lot of issues in a progressive litmus test. Mm-hmm. That it's hard for candidates to say, I don't agree with this or I don't agree with that, that they're being constantly tested that way. Do you think that's the right way? Somebody's figured out how to get a lot of people on different pages in the same direction.
Right.
Is that dangerous for the Democrats, the sort of constant litmus test on various issues?
I guess I don't actually feel like it. I don't think that isn't my perception. I think that what people want to hear, what voters want to understand is, what are your values and what are you really willing to fight for? And what do you stand for? I think that, I mean, I come out of sort of the Democratic, value set. And I think the values that the Democratic Party believes in are ones that are majoritarian values. And I don't think there are any conflicts there. And I think actually, though, maybe a different way of thinking about this is, because I know there's all this conversation, well, if we just could run a candidate just like the guys we've always run for the rest, you know, all of eternity, maybe things would work out. And I think that one of the things that was exciting about this last November, not only this record number of, you know, women and people of color going to Congress, but in the three kind of most highly watched, I think, races in the country, Andrew Gillum running for governor, the young, charismatic governor, mayor running for governor of Florida, Stacey Abrams in Georgia, Beto in Texas. It was the thing that was interesting to me about those races, and they were all close, and they were all like tough races to win, but is they expanded the electorate. And as you know, there are millions and millions of people in this country that just don't vote at all. And so I think rather than thinking about how could we run the same playbook and appeal to the same voters and try to have the same kind of looking people, what if we actually ran people that look like other folks in this country? And maybe then more people would go vote. And that to me is something I think we really have to think about, is that people, the excitement that people felt in those states about having representation that was different than what they'd always had was phenomenal. And I predict, I don't know, of course, what will happen in this primary season since we've got so many people running, but there's going to be either a woman or a person of color on this ticket, I can tell you. I mean, that is like a
Cecile,
radical
I'm going to hold you to that.
I believe it.
And I have to ask, then, if next summer you're standing there at the convention site looking at two white guys on the ticket, what are you going to say?
I don't know what I'm going to say, but I'm going to be serious.
Hi, Joe.
I'm going to be seriously disappointed. I'm going to be seriously disappointed. Look, I mean, I'm not trying to be... Women are the majority of voters in this country. Like, when is it our time? I guess it's just that... And it's not because women are completely 100% better, and it's not because women are a monolith, but maybe we could just try something new. You know? Something a little bit different. I don't know. Anyway...
Something that we're all dealing with now in the news business and politics and everything, the role of the internet and social media.
Right.
And what that means in trying to have a message and trying to communicate. Where are you on that issue right now in terms of what do we do with the fact you don't know who's talking to you,
I know.
Where this is coming from, and it's clearly inflaming the hell out of people out there.
Right.
What to do with that? I would imagine your group especially, what you saw on social media.
I wish I knew what to do. But I do think, I'm trying to look at the ways that it has advantaged some folks who've never had a voice. And so it is exciting to think that particularly young people, women who may not have never broken into the news before now can have a platform. And that's really important. But in the travels I've been doing over the last few months, listening to women, this is one of the single most important issues for them is I need to have someone I can trust that will tell me what's going on because it's incredibly confusing. And I do think that women are looking for how do we build, trusted people, trusted news sources. And because, again, you travel throughout the Midwest, there's a lot of places that there's not a vibrant local paper anymore. There's not a vibrant local news station. Maybe Fox News and Sinclair Broadcasting, maybe all that you get. And so I do think it's important that we find ways to use social media in a way to bring news to people who otherwise, frankly, just may not be able to get it. I think that's what, isn't that what Mark Zuckerberg is supposed to be figuring out and Sheryl Sandberg, but...
How is that working out?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I know. No one's coming to save us but ourselves. And then I guess the only other, only advice I have is just like, don't read the comments section. Comments.
Never.
That's like,
never.
Just don't read the comments.
I want you to tell a story from the book Jared and Ivanka. There's a new book out.
Ask me this.
Well,
I
how could
knew.
I not? There's a new book out that says they may seem nice, but not so much, maybe.
So what happened? What happened? I think that was also a book. So after the election, I was at Planned Parenthood, we were immediately had to like, you know, it's interesting. People say, oh my God, after like, you know, the next morning, I couldn't get out of bed and I stayed in bed for a month. And it's like at Planned Parenthood, the next morning, we got up, we got out of bed. And in fact, I will say, because I'm sure there's some Planned Parenthood folks in this audience, not only did we do that, but despite that election, the next morning, thousands of clinicians and doctors and escorts showed up at Planned Parenthood health centers all across this country. They are some of the bravest people in America, and I just want to give them a shout out as long as I'm here. They thank you for what they do. But I felt like my job was now to figure out, okay, how do we not get defunded? Because, of course, President Trump had promised to do that. And Paul Ryan had promised to do that immediately. It was going to be like their highest priority. So I got word that that Ivanka Trump wanted to talk. And I didn't know her, but I was like, I'll talk to anybody if we can to, you know, talk about what that would mean to you know, deny so many of our patients the ability to come to Planned Parenthood. And then it sort of like went back and forth. And then it was like, so then they wanted me to come. And then it turned out Jared was going to come. So I begged my husband, Kirk, to go with me. And he did. He's such a good guy. He comes out very well in the book, actually. So we drove to the Bedminster Golf Course in New Jersey, which apparently is a Trump golf course, and met. And it was, I guess, supposedly for me to, I don't know actually what was in their mind, but Jared really kind of took the lead. And he basically said, look, after all the pleasantries and ordering their breakfast and this and that, he said, look, you really don't have anywhere to go. You know, we've got the White House, we've got Congress. And so if you're going to make a deal to keep funding for Planned Parenthood, you're going to have to make it with us. And, you know, basically time's short here. And I said, well, I would hope to be able to tell you all the great things that Planned Parenthood does and the important care. Because basically, if you're defunding us, that's all the preventive care that we provide. That's, you know, pap smears, you know, birth control. And he said, yeah, I know. But yeah, you run a great business. I think he thought Kirk worked for me or something. Like maybe it was like a family business. But he said, but we gotta, you know, but listen, we've got the votes. We can defund you. And then the only thing really Ivanka said is she said she was very hurt that I hadn't thanked her father because he had said something nice about Planned Parenthood in one of the, I guess in some press conference. And I said, well, he did say that. And then he said he was going to defund us. So I'm not sure how he's supposed to wedge that thank you in before he said, and we're going to cut off all their funding. That was her main concern, that it hadn't been fair to her dad. Anyway, Jared said, well, listen, this is the deal. You guys quit providing abortion services, and I will talk to Paul Ryan, and we'll not only secure your funding, we'll get you more money. And I said, okay, well, that's not gonna work. And he said, this is just what he said, this is what he would envision. A big headline in the New York Times that said, Planned Parenthood discontinues abortion services. And I said, that headline is never going to run in the New York Times. So that's not going to happen. And that was it. That was it. It was really, I mean, I guess I just would say they wanted to make a political deal. My analysis of this is they wanted to make a political deal so that they could go back and claim that they were these political deal makers. And they were friends with Paul Ryan, and they had gotten Planned Parenthood to, you know, relent. And it was, I mean, I think it was an experience and a sort of a way of operating that we've now seen operate the same way over the last 2.5 years. They didn't care about the women we served. They didn't care about the care we provided. They wanted a political scalp, and we weren't going to give it to them. And I will just say, and that, you know, the amazing thing, and this is one of the other lessons I've learned in my long life of organizing, is never give up, because we never had the votes. He was right. We never had the votes in the Senate. And yet, I'll never forget being on Capitol Hill, outside in the dark, as we're all waiting for that vote that night. And Patty Murray had told me, she said, Cecile, we're just within one vote. but I don't think we're going to make it. And that night, watching John McCain go thumbs down, you know what? And that was worth it. That was worth it. And if we had ever given up, that wouldn't have happened. And so I just like to thank Paul Ryan, who said we were going to be defunded. You know, he's retired, and Planned Parenthood stores are still open all across the United States of America. So that's...
Have you heard from Jared and Ivanka since?
No. I mean, Ivanka called a couple of times in between. He's like, how's it going? How are we doing on this deal? And I was like... I said, there isn't a deal. We're not going to make a deal. We're not going to trade away women's rights for money. And, that was it.
Last question before you guys get to ask them. So be thinking, and we have people who will walk down the aisles with microphones. One of the things I took from the book is you seized opportunities as they came. You didn't really plot, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that.
True that.
What is the message and the lesson to young women in this audience who are trying to figure it out and feel like they need to have a blueprint? What would you say to them?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question. It came up earlier from someone, and yes, I didn't have a career path. I just felt like and what I guess I try to tell young people is, one, this is the only life you have, okay? So do it now. Don't wait. And as we say now, don't wait for instructions. I think, though, if you are privileged enough to get to make a difference in the world and you have the opportunity to, find something that you feel like makes a difference, then hold out for that. Because if you do, if you find the thing that you were put on the earth to do, and I feel like I have been so blessed to be able to always have a job that I felt like made a difference, it's sort of just hard to describe. And I think that's what I try to say to young women is like, and young men, wait for that thing. And if you do, you will leave a joyful life, and you will meet the most amazing people on the path, and you'll leave the world a better place. And there's just really nothing better than that. My mom used to say, and she too was in a lot of rooms with a lot of fancy people, and she said, you can go a lot of places, you can make a lot of money, but there's nothing quite like doing work where someone comes to you and says, thank you for making my life better. And that's worth it all. So that's what I would hold out for.
I think that's a great note to end on.
Sorry, realizing.
That gentleman right there, his hand shot up, the gentleman in the blue jacket.
Good evening, good evening.
Hi.
I bought tickets to this a very long time ago, and it is surreal for me to be here in your physical presence. Thank you.
Well, I'm glad you're here.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming.
Now, my question is in regards to words, because words like Black Lives, like books, like albums, words and facts matter.
Yep.
And I'm curious, from your perspective, I consider myself a feminist. From your perspective, why is that among one of the key buzzwords that it's so demonized?
Yeah, I think it's kind of making a comeback. It's my hope. But I think, who knows? It's a really good question. And not everyone never... I think that labels in and of themselves are tough. And we found that at Planned Parenthood, particularly young people, they don't want to be labeled in so many different ways, and maybe that's one of the things that feminism says. But I do think it's important that those of us who believe in equal rights for all people, regardless of gender and everything else, that we actually talk about that's actually what feminism is about. And I think that the hard thing is if you're trying to get people to ascribe to a certain way of saying that it doesn't always work. But I'm kind of hopeful about... And maybe I would be interested. I know there's a lot of... One, I just like so thrilled. There's so many men in the audience. So that's really exciting. So thank you guys for being so fully evolved and with it and cool. It's funny. So I grew up in Texas where... I mean, we couldn't even play full court basketball when I grew up, right? They didn't think we could run the full court, right? So we had to run halfway and then like throw the ball to somebody on the other side so they could run down and try to make a basket. So I grew up in a culture that where women had, they were like almost no expectations of us. And I feel like, and I'd be curious if anyone has a reaction to this, I feel like we are at a interesting inflection point now where a lot of fathers in this country have great expectations for their daughters. And they expect that their daughters should have every single opportunity that their sons have. And you can't have that unless you obviously have bodily autonomy and can make decisions about your life. And so I'm kind of hopeful, because I don't think that equality, women's equality, we are never going to get there on our own. It's going to have to be us all like marching down this road together. So I guess I am kind of hopeful that whether men call themselves feminists or not, but you're cool that you do, so I'm like, that's, I think that's awesome, that we do have to reach into to and have conversation and hear from men who I just think are fundamentally generationally making a shift. One of the most inspiring things about being at the Women's March was seeing dads and brothers and sons, and my son Daniel came, and I loved it. I saw a dad holding a sign that said, I'm so honored to be marching with the future president of the United States. I don't know who she is, but I know she's here today. So anyway, but we've got work to do, and we definitely can't, we got to have a movement that brings everybody along.
You talked about listening to people and getting a sense of where, what their needs really are.
Yep.
I want to posit for a moment that those people that are dead set against us, the Pences, and are scared. They're scared, and this goes for a lot of the poor people who are scared of losing their jobs, scared of losing their position, but most of all, scared of losing control, and that to allow women to control our own lives is so threatening to them about what they might be losing that we've got to find other ways. And where do we go from there to persuade people that they can have a life, even if they can't have that kind of control, that they're going to live in a brown and black world or a multicolored world, and women need to have autonomy and they need to get it.
Yep.
How do we do that?
Yeah. No, I mean, I think this is the central question is, and, you know, my friend Gloria Steinem says, well, first, I love, she says, you know, the truth will set you free, but first it'll piss you off, which is one of my favorite. But the other is that people don't give up power without a struggle. And so I do think, look, here's the facts and why I think we're kind of at this interesting moment now in the country. It's not just that women are marching in record numbers, running for office in record numbers. Women are now almost half the workforce, which was not true of the first women's movement, right? Women are now more than half the college students, medical students, law students. We actually just almost had the first women's spacewalk, and if they couldn't find a suit that would fit, but we're going to fix that. So
yeah.
I think that's that is a very different thing. And the thing that's kind of amazing to me is that women have managed to do all this and actually work within a system that was not built for us to be there, right? I mean, the fact that we have no, you know, we still don't have equal pay, the fact that we don't have any child care system in this country, that we only developed country that has no paid family leave, that's, you know, we somehow managed to get this far without all that. Imagine if actually we could take care of those issues. We could really have a humming economy, and women could really have equality. But I do think it's threatening. And I think that you look at this administration appointing essentially white conservative men to the federal judiciary. I mean, they are digging in for the long haul here. But I'm hopeful because I just, again, I may have talked to this earlier, like, one, the country is getting more diverse. It's just like, that is just, that's coming. That's coming to my home state of Texas. I mean, Beto may not have won, but we saw the pathway there. You just can't, that's a bell that can't be unrung, as mom would say. Every year, 4 million young people turn 18, right? So that's 16 million young people who didn't vote 4 years ago that are eligible to vote, and we should invest every single ounce of time and energy we have to make sure they're registered and then they're getting out to vote, because they're going to change the country. But some people aren't going to go easily because it is about giving up power. But I just think if we focus on them, we're focusing on the wrong thing, in my opinion. I think we should focus on the millions of people who are saying, we want opportunity, we want change, we want our daughters to have opportunity, our communities. And if we do that, and if everyone does just a little bit more than what they're doing now, I do think we're going to change the direction of America. And I think 2020, I think there's a real opportunity to do that.
I was curious about your thoughts regarding the second in command and, you know, the prospect of us having a President Pence. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
You really bring me down now. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was also curious if you had any comments about that campaign that women ran in Indiana, the Periods for Pence.
Right.
Thing. Yeah.
He's mentioning wonderful Periods for Pence that was run in the state of Indiana. I thought you were going to say, have you ever really spent any time with Mike Pence? And I'd say, well, no, he won't actually meet with any women unless his wife is present. But I don't think Donald Trump has an ideology. He's about building himself up and making a lot of money and feeling powerful. There's nothing else behind it. Mike Pence, on the other hand, he's a true believer. So I do think they are very, very different. And he's, even though he never passed a bill when he was in Congress, he is a student of Washington, D.C. And so he actually, I think, if something were to happen to President to 45, I just can't quite get there. But then I do think that he would be a very, very formidable opponent. I mean, I think he acquits himself very well. I thought it was interesting in this conversation about the ACA that he was one of the folks, supposedly, who knows, that reporters say was against this move to go after the health care again, because I think he just has a better political sense than the president does. So yeah, and of course he was terrible for us in Indiana in terms of healthcare, in terms of the LGBTQ community, in terms of Planned Parenthood. So he would be a really formidable opponent. And I think a lot of the policy things that we are seeing executed in HHS and so on, those are not coming from the president. Those are coming from the vice president and the folks who kind of believe in his ideology.
Hi, thank you so much for coming. Really great talk. I'm a graduate of Smith College. It's one of the last few great, places for women to really grow and discuss. We have a great Friday thing that we do now online, which is Smith Tea. We've taken tea from campus and brought it online. It's a great place for lots of us to talk. Long story short, a very common recurring trend right now is men who are seeing these fantastic paternity leave packages from their employers, and my fellow Smithies going, what the hell? You know, they give birth, they've got to be back either paid or unpaid 2 to 4 weeks. Their husbands are there on 12 weeks. So I'm getting a lot of stories on there like, hey, I got home from work, my husband didn't do anything around the house, and then he proceeded to tell me how exhausting it was taking care of the newborn. So how do we help these women that are getting shoved back into work? Yeah. And then how do we also recruit their husbands who are now enjoying their cushy paternity leaves to help fight for the women who are birthing those children to get equal maternity leaves as well?
Right. That's a lot of stuff there. And that's, it's unbelievable that obviously, yes, I think, we need a national policy of maternity leave for everyone. And it is insane. I just met this young woman in Austin who said, I fought so hard to get maternity leave at my tech company. And of course it's too late for me now, because she said I'd already have my children. And now I realize this isn't, we can't solve it one by one. We got to solve this politically. So that to me is why we have to lift up. This has to be universal. It can't be everybody for themselves. And it has been, and has been for too long. And I think that it's one of the things, I think if we had, look, people ask me, when will we quit, you know, fighting over these kinds of issues, birth control, maternity care, all that. And that's when half of Congress can get pregnant, we're going to actually have justice in this arena. And we've got to fight for that. But it is, and that's, I think that is actually some of the radicalization, and I want to use that word in a like a gentle way, but is that women then begin to experience what it is like to actually, the workplace isn't made for us, maternity care is, and pregnancy is treated as like it's a nuisance, as opposed to a fundamental healthcare issue for millions of people, and it's the way we all got here, right? So, keep fighting, keep organizing, and go elect people to office who care about these issues. Okay?
And that lady right there in the middle, yes. I know you've probably answered this question at least once before. Would you ever consider running for a high office?
Yeah. I have answered that a few times, and now I just say never say never, you know? And that's kind of what because I think I used to say, oh, not me, and then I go like, I don't know. Maybe some great opportunity comes its way. And I will say, I think we are all, I don't think there's a the joy and enthusiasm that women are feeling and the excitement they're feeling about seeing women in office that look like them, that have their same lived experience, it is infectious. So if not me, there are millions of women in this country and women of color who are capable and ready, and we just got to be out there, and we got to be out there and support them. And I guess, and the other question that has come up, and I'll just maybe, you know, close on this part, is that I think it's important that men look around and make space for women in office, because you know what? That's part of our obligation as well, and that white women make space for women of color, that this world's not going to change. I mean, it's part of the reason I left Planned Parenthood, the best job in America, honest. It's like the most incredible organization, does so much good. But I felt like, you know what? I need to move over and let someone else have this incredible opportunity. And so I just think all of us have to think about the ways in which we can lift other folks up and bring them along, because that's how we're going to have a real democracy. So anyway.
Well, thank you for coming out. Thank you to Cecile.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.